Syrian government, the Iraqi government, the Libyan government, and the Saudi government that in the past gave symbolic support, but they did not want in any way to push for the humiliation of Israel in the battlefield because they were scared of Israeli responses.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up, it's Radio Zine with Got Science asking, when science is neglected, who's hurt most? Then at 11:30, we have Sprouts, which sees how U.S. currency relies on oil.
KBOO Community Radio is working with Beautiful Portland to collect socks and blankets for those who are sleeping outside this winter. There is a collection box in the lobby of KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, between Burnside and Ankeny. Donations are accepted Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of All Things Must Pass, a 50th anniversary celebration on Saturday, February 1st, from 8 to 11 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. All Things Must Pass was a triple album released by George Harrison in 1970, and this tribute event will feature 30-plus musicians from Portland's music scene who will perform the first four sides of the record. Again, that's All Things Must Pass, a 50th anniversary celebration on Saturday, February 1st, from 8 to 11 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show, with a portion of proceeds donated to the Jeremy Wilson Foundation Musicians Emergency Healthcare Fund. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to the Got Science Podcast. I'm your host, Colleen McDonald. Take a deep breath. What do you feel? Keep that in mind as you listen to today's podcast on the air we breathe. And stick around after the interview for another installment of This Week in Science History with Katie Love. Recently, I was reminiscing with a friend of mine, reminiscing about how dirty the air was when we were kids, though she had it a lot worse having grown up in LA. This was in the late 60s, before the Clean Air Act had passed. She remembers not being allowed to run at recess because the air quality was so bad, taking a deep breath literally hurt. Then starting in 1970, the country decided enough is enough and passed a new flood of environmental legislation, including the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and a ban on DDT, an insecticide that was decimating populations of endangered bird species, like the bald eagle. Laws like these showed America's commitment to using the best available scientific information to reduce environmental harm and risks to human health. And we all started breathing a little easier. Thanks to these science-based protections, human and environmental health have improved by leaps and bounds since I was a kid. But what happens when the government stops using scientific evidence to design these protections, or dismantles the protections entirely? In the fall of 2019, the Union of Concerned Scientists released a report that answered these questions. The researchers found that everyone's health is put in danger, but not equally. Marginalized communities are harmed most of all. To unpack these findings, I sat down with Anita Desikan, author of the report and research analyst here at UCS. We talked about how she did her research, why the EPA stopped doing its job, and what the consequences have been. But Anita also shares the hopeful stories of communities that are fighting back and explained how scientists and non-scientists can be very powerful partners in these efforts. Anita, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to be here with you. So you co-authored a report called Abandoned Science, Broken Promises that looked at an increased environmental threat to marginalized communities under the Trump administration. How did you approach the analysis?
The way we approached it was we wanted to do three types of methodologies: the case study methodology on these attacks on science, quantitative data analyses, and three, to find stories from our community partners. I'll give you an example of one of these data analyses that we did. It was to look, and it's a good way to tie how attacks on science hurt everyone and are disproportionately hurting marginalized communities. So there's this chemical called PFAS. It's unfortunately, it's omnipresent right now in the environment. It's in your blood, it's in my blood right now, and the more you have it, the worse your symptoms are. There was a report by the CDC in 2018 that talked about just how dangerous this particular chemical, or I should say a class of chemicals, are. And the Trump administration, they buried the report. Now, public outcry caused the report to be eventually published, and it's just showing how bad this particular chemical is. So our data analysis was to look at whether this chemical has an equity component, whether marginalized communities are more affected by it. So we looked at surface water, groundwater contamination, really contaminated sites all across the U.S., and kind of drew a five-mile radius around it. What are the communities living within these 5 miles of very, very contaminated sites? The communities tend to be, unfortunately, communities of color and low-income communities. We found that 40,000 more low-income households are located in this five-mile range, more than you'd expect as compared to the U.S. average. And for people of color, it's 300,000, or I should say just a little under 300,000 more people of color than expected based on the U.S. Census.
How should the administration deal with a situation like this? What would the ideal way to handle that be?
Well, the ideal way is honestly to prioritize science-based decision-making. When policies are not based on science, when policy is unhinged from science, it means that special interests can take precedence, special interests can take that void. Now, scientific evidence is one of the best ways we have to determine ways to set health and safety measures, and it saves people's lives. So the fact that our administration is devaluing science on so many levels, devaluing standards that protect us from air pollution, and therefore we can't have policies or have fewer policies that protect us, that controls air pollution. And of course, this is disproportionately affecting marginalized communities.
When you say deprioritizing, what exactly does that mean? I mean, the EPA has a mission, and they're supposed to be keeping checks and balances on this. So, like, what specifically happens that they're not doing that job?
It occurs in a variety of ways. Take enforcement, for example. The EPA is required by law to enforce certain environmental laws, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, for instance. Now, we did an analysis to determine whether the EPA is actually doing that under this administration, and the unfortunate answer is no. We looked at criminal polluters. These are people who are breaking the laws in terms of these environmental laws. And they, if you compare the Trump administration's ability to go after these criminals, it's decreased by 34% to 47% if you compare it to the prior two administrations at the same time point. Science is a tool that we should be using to help people. Science is behind the things like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, and we're not using that science to literally help people from criminals that are polluting our air and water and land.
So if I work at the EPA and my job is to do water quality or air quality testing, that's what I come in the morning to do. How is that not happening? Is it because those people aren't there, that these scientists haven't been hired?
In some respects, you're right. It is a lack of capacity. We actually have seen that in previous analyses, talking to federal scientists, and they're saying there's not people here to do those jobs. And that's also why enforcement is down as well. I'll take it in another vein, though. At the EPA, there are programs that are specifically designed to help marginalized communities. I'm going to highlight the Office of Environmental Justice. They have incredible grants that are given to community activists trying to stop environmental justice issues occurring in their own backyard. And when we did an analysis on this, what we found was that there's a 70 to 79% decrease in the number of grants issued to community groups to literally help themselves. It's not just there's a lack of capacity to even do the air testing and to do the water quality testing. It's the fact that even agencies in the EPA that have been designed to help our underserved communities, that is their purpose, even they're getting sidelined and dismantled, and they're just getting unable to do their jobs.
How did you define underserved communities in the analysis?
We looked at communities, three different types of communities: communities of color, low-income communities, and indigenous communities. Communities that have been sidelined, that have been ignored, honestly, since the founding of our nation. You could even argue that the founding of our nation was based on systematic discrimination towards these groups. So we wanted to see if, again, when science is taken out of the policymaking process, if there's disproportionate impacts. And it angers me so much that is what is occurring under the Trump administration. It angers me that something that's been going on for 200 plus years of our country's history is getting worse and worse day by day.
So let's talk for a minute about previous administrations. This isn't new in the Trump administration. So how does this administration compare to others?
That's an excellent question, because these concerns aren't new. Environmental justice advocates, they know the harms that have been occurring in their communities. I'll give an example. In Portland, Oregon, there's an area that's been a traditionally Black community for almost all of the 20th century. And this community has a congregation of industrial facilities nearby, places that undoubtedly pollute the air and the water, and it gets concentrated in the Black community. So in the 70s, the community activists said, can you please, please put zoning permits there to prevent industrial facilities setting up shop right next door? And they were absolutely ignored, and the area continues to be polluted. So it's not just the Trump administration that's causing, that's the be-all and end-all of these pollution harms. It's been happening for a very, very long time.
We'll be back in a minute with the second half of our interview. The Got Science podcast is brought to you by the Union of Concerned Scientists. More at gotsciencepodcast.org. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, PRX, SoundCloud, and all the usual podcast outlets. For a transcript and links to additional resources from this episode and a full bio of our guest, head over to gotsciencepodcast.org. If you like the podcast, you can help us reach more people by simply sharing the podcast with your friends, coworkers, and social networks. Another way to help us get noticed is by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. And finally, if you're on Twitter, come talk to us at GotScienceUCS. Now let's get back to our interview.
Another example of the harms that are occurring in marginalized communities because of the Trump administration's attacks on science is something like SNAP. So SNAP was formerly called food stamps. And this is a program that has been designed to give low-income individuals the ability to eat food. I feel like everyone should be wanting this and cheering for such an amazing program. And the program, according to the science, has shown its success tenfold, a hundredfold. Children who are under this program are less likely to be born with low birth rates. The people under this program take fewer sick days. It uplifts people out of poverty. Now, the Trump administration instead has put work requirements onto SNAP, which will almost by definition push people off SNAP. According to their own estimate, actually, it's about 750,000 people over a course of 3 years. So again, this is the administration deciding that to devalue and ignore and marginalized communities that are, it's just literally food for low-income individuals.
Yeah, another example you've found is that the administration isn't allowing data to be collected on certain issues.
So this is the most insidious of this. When you don't have data to show the effects that are occurring in marginalized communities, you can't find out that there's even a problem, and you can't manage that problem.
Right, you can't make a case for it if you don't have anything.
Exactly. If there's no data, if there's no research, the issue is not even visible to anyone, to any policymaker. So I'll give one example when data collection was not allowed by the administration. And so it occurred in Houston, Texas. If you remember, in 2017, Hurricane Harvey hit and caused immense damages to the chemical facilities in the area. Huge amounts of hazardous air were spewing very just horrible chemicals into the air. And what we would want to do is find out where are the hotspots occurring, how can we protect the communities that are next door, which again are mainly marginalized community members. So NASA scientists happened to be watching, like literally just kind of turning on their TVs and noticing this is occurring or reading in the newspapers, and they were horrified. And so this particular group of NASA scientists had had a tool called the DC-8. It's a type of airplane that's considered the world's most sophisticated way to measure air pollution. It's like, it can measure about 400 species of air pollutants. It's an incredible device. And so they talked to their bosses, they got all the approvals they needed, and they said they diverted the plane from an already scheduled mission, and they said, you know what, they told the EPA, they told Texas authorities, we are going to come and help. We are going to provide, again, really incredible data collection that will show where the hotspots are occurring and help protect people. Instead, the EPA and Texas authorities said, absolutely not. They called a second data analysis, quote unquote, confusing, because they already had an analysis that showed it wasn't that much of a problem. But again, more data shouldn't be disparaged or shouldn't be forbidden when it's being offered by scientists who want to do good in the world. And so I have to admit that things like that are incredibly scary to me as a scientist, because when scientists are told, do not do your science, when scientists are forbidden to offer their services to literally help people, to save the lives of people, it's a very chilling message. And the impacts are occurring, again, disproportionately on marginalized groups. That means the concerns that they're seeing every day, every single day, the people's whose lives they're seeing perish, they are not able to get the proper scientific data to show that this is occurring due to a pollution source next door. And that is chilling.
You mentioned in the report that some communities are fighting back and having some success. Tell me about some of those communities.
So we worked with two community partners for the report, Tejas, which is doing great work in Houston, Texas, and Clean Power Lake County, which is doing great work in Illinois. So I'll take Tejas first. So Tejas has been trying to mobilize and help communities that are living next door to chemical facilities. So, and these communities are mostly low-income individuals and people of color. We actually previously worked with Tejas to show that acute and chronic exposures are occurring in primarily these types of marginalized communities. Now, Tejas has been fighting back against the EPA in a variety of different areas when they try to roll back chemical safety protections. So I'll give you in a recent example, it's called the RMP rule, the Risk Management Program rule. And this is one that just says when an emergency happens in a chemical facility, there should be a plan in place. Information about the dangerous chemicals stored should be known to or should be available to communities and other members of the public. Very, very common sense sort of things.
I would want to know that.
Exactly, right? And so this rule was delayed by over a year by the Trump administration for implementation. Tejas has been actively fighting against that delay. And unfortunately, the administration very recently did a partial rollback of this rule. Now communities can't find out what chemicals are literally next door to them in these giant facilities. And there are less chances for analyses when something goes wrong. There's less requirements for the companies to analyze when things go wrong. So again, there's mobilization, there's continued mobilization, there's strengthening of these rules. The administration is going to continue to do bad things, but I have a lot of hope in community groups like Tejas that help their community say, hey, there's a bad air pollution day, please go indoors, shelter in space, that talk to our congressional representatives, that talk to our state and local representatives and say, okay, the administration is not on our side, please help us. Clean Power Lake County is also doing work that's in the same vein. Again, this is where my hope is coming in from community groups. They're fighting the good fight, and I want to support them so much. And so in Lake County, this is an area that's traditionally Spanish-speaking, that has a lot of people of color and low-income individuals in the area, and there are chemical facilities that are spewing a variety of different gases in the air, and I'll focus in on one, which is ethylene oxide. It's a cancer-causing gas. They've highlighted that there's an inequity going on here. The EPA is protecting and helping advocates from wealthy and affluent communities battling the same cancer-causing gas, but are less willing to do things for the community that's, well, not in that demographic. So that's what Clean Power Lake County is fighting against, and they've been doing a great job at it. And so in terms of where I find a lot of hope, it's in terms of people fighting and fighting and fighting.
So they're fighting and they're making incremental progress and they have to keep fighting.
Yeah.
Which is sad in some ways that you can't live your life the way other people do, that you have to be fighting all the time.
That's exactly true. And that's why it's important for all of us to be allies to community groups that are doing such good work. Honestly, for everyone on this podcast, you can vote. And your vote makes a huge difference in helping communities. By voting, you elect representatives that care about these issues, that care about environmental justice. Because when we don't have officials that consider scientific integrity, environmental justice, issues like this, then they either won't enact laws or regulations or other types of protections for marginalized communities, or they might even actively dismantle the protections already in place. The people you vote for make a difference. And I'll also give a pitch to the scientists that are listening to this podcast here. Scientists, you have an incredible position to help marginalized communities by working with them, by partnering with them, by doing research in community groups. So the science is an incredible tool for communities to advocate for. If they have a scientific study in front of them that says, the scientists corroborate what I've been telling you for years, the asthma that I'm getting, that my family is getting, that my neighbors are getting, are, according to the science, are associated with the industrial facility next door. That is a very, very powerful thing to tell to their decision makers. And scientists have the ability to provide that type of technical training and service that can help communities figure out what are the right data sets to go to, what are the right methodologies to think about, how does science work in terms of looking at associations between an environmental exposure and a health effect. Scientists can play a role with partnering with community groups and helping them in their advocacy efforts to stop these situations that are occurring, to stop these polluting, horrible situations that are occurring.
And I think one thing that you mentioned that I think is really important is asking scientists to work with community partners to find out what it is that they need that's going to help their community.
That is a major concern sometimes. If scientists have already figured out all the methodologies, all the ways that they're collecting the data, and then just expect for their community groups to to allow them, it's not a true partnership. It's not equitable. And I think we want science to be more equitable. So to give an example of an equitable relationship, Yvette Arellano from Tejas has told us that there are gas flarings that can occur at odd times of the day, like in wee hours of the morning kind of thing. So if scientists were to go to that community and test the air pollution in the area, they might not be recording the air pollution times at, let's say, 3 a.m. So without that knowledge from a community member who can literally tell you how to make your science better, it's something that we should be pursuing. We should be acknowledging that community members have incredible knowledge. And when we do science in their area, they need to be not only consulted, but not only consulted and informed, but brought into the process in an equitable manner that helps all of us.
Well, Anita, thanks for joining me. Let's go through your two things that you said earlier, that people, you can vote, that will really make a difference.
Yes, yes.
And scientists, you can partner with communities and listen to them and help with the science that you do.
Exactly. Despite the current administration's obviously anti-science policies, there are things that we as people, we as scientists can do. We can help. We can aid community efforts to prevent these terrible things.
Well, thank you, Anita.
Thank you very much.
And now it's time for This Week in Science History with Katie Love.
This week in science history, we're going to two different events, more than 30 years and around 4,000 miles apart. The first was on January 24, 1961, when a B-52 bomber carrying two 24-megaton nuclear bombs broke apart in midair, causing the pilots to eject and the bombs to drop. The force of the breakup caused the arming sequence of the bombs to start. One bomb hit the ground and shattered after its parachute failed. The other bomb's parachute deployed, with only one of the six safety switches preventing a nuclear explosion. That switch was later found to be defective in many bombs and was replaced. The crash took place in a swampy area. A part of one of the bombs, containing uranium, was never recovered. The Air Force now owns an easement for the land where the bombs fell and requires permission for anyone who wants to dig in the area. After the incident, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara stated that, by the slightest margin of chance, literally the failure of two wires to cross, a nuclear explosion was averted. The second event, on January 25, 1995, involved a Russian early warning radar, which detected an unexpected missile launch off the coast of Norway. By a dangerous and unexpected coincidence, the missile's flight characteristics looked similar to that of a U.S. submarine-launched ballistic missile, leading radar operators to believe that the missile might detonate a nuclear warhead high in the atmosphere, blinding Russian radars before a larger attack was launched. Russian nuclear forces went on full alert, awaiting the order from President Boris Yeltsin to launch a retaliatory strike. Russian early warning satellites did not see any additional launches from U.S. missile silos, leading Russian leaders to decide it was a false alarm. The detected missile was actually the launch of a U.S.-Norwegian scientific rocket on a mission to study the Aurora Borealis, or Northern Lights. Norway had notified Russia in advance of the launch, but their notification didn't contain enough information to raise concerns, and the innocuous science experiment escalated into a high-risk nuclear incident. These two events help show that human error is rife, even with something as world-altering as nuclear weapons. So you would think our policymakers would want to do everything they can to ensure our safety with sensible nuclear weapons policy. And yet current policy allows the United States to launch these missiles on warning of an incoming attack, despite a long history of false alarms and close calls, like the ones I've just described. In fact, many of the Cold War's most absurd and dangerous nuclear policies remain unchanged. In the United States, the president can order the launch of nuclear weapons without consulting anyone. And U.S. policy allows it to use nuclear weapons first in a non-nuclear conflict, likely starting a nuclear war. These policies threaten the world in very real ways, and they need to change. Learn how you can help make that change at ucsusa.org/nuclearweapons.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Got Science podcast. Got Science is made possible by the 130,000 members of UCS, and especially our partners for the Earth, the 12,000 supporters who make monthly contributions to stand up for science. Learn more at ucsusa.org/partners. Special thanks to research scientist Anita Desikan. This Week in Science History by Katie Love. Editing by Omari Spears. Music and additional editing by Brian Middleton. Research and writing by Pamela Wirth and Jiayu Liang. Our executive producer is Rich Hayes, and I'm your host, Colleen MacDonald. Come find us on Twitter at GotScienceUCS. Thanks, and see you next time.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 11:30 a.m. Next up, we have Sprouts. Sprouts sees how U.S. currency relies on oil.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience, produced at a different location every week. I'm Alex Wise of Sea Change Radio. Today on Sprouts, we talk to James Quilligan, an economist and policy analyst, about the commons and the future of democracy. This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Society does not have a good understanding that the assets of nature are the real value of our currencies, even though it's not recognized. What we have now is a currency that is really attendant to the value of oil.
What is the American dollar based on? It was based on the gold standard until 1971, when it transitioned to a floating monetary system. This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, however, believes U.S. currency now rests, unofficially, on the price of oil. What will a successful Green New Deal look like if the underlying currency upon which the U.S. economy rests is based on fossil fuels? We speak to James Quilligan, a senior advisor for economic democracy advocates and longtime policy analyst in the international development space. Quilligan explains the history of the commons and monetary policy, points out some of the shortcomings of capitalism, and lays out how to ensure the survival of democracy. He argues that understanding the complexities of our global economic system is the first step in fixing it. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by James Quilligan. He's the Managing Director of Economic Democracy Advocates. James, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. I'm really happy to be here.
So first, James, what is Economic Democracy Advocates all about? What's your organization's mission?
We train people to advocate for economic democracy, as the title says. We believe that small units of people can help us to restore democracy, which is we're rapidly losing, as a lot of your listeners know. Because what we've been experiencing is a centralized kind of democracy. We believe in decentralized horizontal democracy where groups can actually do two things. They can create their own democratic protocols to manage their common resources, mm-hmm. and they can also talk to elected officials to change the laws of the land. And so I think what, you know, the local democracy groups at regional and local levels are very important to become advocates for democracy, not only through their own initiatives in social action, but also in petitioning their governments to make new laws.
So explain the notion of the commons and then segue, if you will, into how we lost it.
The simple answer is the commons are everything that isn't controlled by government. If you look around on a sort of phenomenological basis, everything you experience in life is part of a commons. The air, the water, the food, your social relationships, your relaxing time activities, your hobbies. It's really all-encompassing. Libraries are a commons, parks, streets, sidewalks. And then the internet is a commons. We think of all those things as public utilities in some ways, especially when they're operated by governments. But they're really more than that. What's happened is we've lost those commons, many of them. They're eroding from our grip. Over the last, let's say, five centuries since the New World was discovered, 1492 or whenever in that period you want to choose as the turning point, there have been a lot of policies enacted by governments across the world to restrict the use of commons. And so there was an enclosure movement, not only in Great Britain, which is the most famous place, but really everywhere in the world. Boundaries were set up around our commons and excluding the people who used to live on the commons without particular formal laws to govern them. And now by creating formal laws around the commons, some people began to own them or purchase them, and some people began to regulate them. And so a lot of people got marginalized from their own commons and drifted into city environments and labor practices, which really didn't benefit them. So we're at a point right now where the internet is being commercialized, the skies are being commercialized. So we're moving in a direction where we're trying to privatize even the elements of nature. Harvard has copyrighted some of the elements of nature. So it has to do with how government and business have encroached upon our commons and how we need to be able to roll that back and do it in a peaceful way, but do it in a firm way whereby we can generate new laws to govern a sea change for a systematic transformation of the economy and also the way we're being governed.
I can't help but think of people in more rural parts of the country who one would assume would have a lot more open space to run around and play in, but that's often not the case because of the way we enforce private property in rural America. So someplace in the city with lots of parks, there may be more room for children to run around and play in than there would be in the middle of quote-unquote nowhere. Maybe you can kind of flesh out that analogy for me.
You're touching on the key point here, which is that the commons is being privatized to a great extent. And, you know, in the past, we had governments to protect the public interest. And so many of the commons, like national parks or even state parks, were under the watch of government who felt that it was in the public interest to have these as protected areas, as well as areas that were being conserved for future generations for the sake of protecting the natural environment. But that's changing really rapidly. And with population growth, with an increase in non-renewable resources, we're running out of petrol, we're running out of food in some ways, we're running out of, certainly running out of water that's accessible. And clean air is, we're running short of that, not only because of climate change, but the pollution that is attendant to that. There's a real push now to privatize more and more because not only do the people who are privatizing see markets in all this, if only we could go back to the time when things were being regulated by governments, but that day is not here, which is one of the reasons why we think that legislation is still part of the answer. We can protect our local communities, whether we're in regional rural areas or regional dense populated areas like big cities by recognizing that we all live within a particular bioregion. And if we were to govern that bioregion the way we pretend to govern our political units, each of those districts is supposed to represent the people in a particular area. But what's happened is they may be doing that to some extent, but those districts cut across regional boundaries, and therefore they cut across our bioregions. And the idea that we think is right is that we can begin to unify the rural and urban populations to a greater extent, because in many ways what we have is a lot of the red states are rural and a lot of the blue states are more urban. We can actually begin to heal that if we came into a common framework where we recognize that the most important thing right now is to protect our bioregions. Because if we did that and we governed them effectively, then we can actually become much more self-sufficient. It would have many benefits economically, ecologically, culturally, politically, but we're not even close to doing that yet. So that's one of the areas that economic democracy advocates is trying to bring forward.
And the idea of borders, these hard borders that we take for granted, is a relatively new concept in a lot of ways, isn't it?
You mean in terms of sovereign borders?
Yes.
Yeah, we've had sovereign borders since what was called the Treaty of Westphalia. So sovereignty, modern sovereignty, was created about four centuries ago, I guess. And so all of us have grown up by it. We've been conditioned into it. We believe that national states have hard borders. And the Club of Nations, through the United Nations and through a lot of international activities, have all agreed that, you know, it's very important to keep these borders hard. Now, so what's happened, though, under neoliberalism, the borders became softer in order to facilitate trade across borders and also to develop monetary exchange across borders, to promote tourism, to ease up issuance of passports so that people could move about more easily. And now there's a lot of pushback against those hard borders now, against the softer borders, which you could associate with globalization. So globalization meant the new movement toward softer borders. And part of the populist nationalism that you see emerging today is insisting on a return to the hard borders, is where we keep out immigrants and we move into areas of bilateral trade rather than multilateral trade. We have much more regulation of our borders as a result.
And how do you see climate change encroaching on that very concept as we have more and more asylum seekers due to disruption to the more vulnerable populations in areas that are exposed to the elements?
Well, climate change is really a catalyst in all of this because it is clearly producing climate refugees who are in the United States. They're coming up from Central America and Mexico, but it's happening everywhere. It's been happening all over Africa. And obviously, very famously, it happened in Syria, and that drove the greater immigration into Europe. Which has created, a crisis in Europe and facilitated nationalist populism in Europe in a very forceful way over the last several years. So climate change has a lot to do with this. It was a problem that was festering for a while, but climate change has certainly given the impetus to really weigh the benefits of either sort of a right-wing populism or a more progressive view of how to manage local and regional commons.
What we lay bare, then don't expose, disguise our failure in poem or prose. What we can't see or not forecast, and then life goes on, this too will pass. We hide and get the loneliest view. A kid'll never come around and split the sky in two. Behind every timely split the sky in two. Goodbye. Get along. Goodbye.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to James Quilligan. He's the managing director of Economic Democracy Advocates. So, James, let's turn to monetary policy and the Green New Deal. Why don't we take a step back and explain how Bretton Woods and that 1944 meeting in New Hampshire created quote-unquote modern monetary policy, how that changed in the early 70s and where we are now.
The Bretton Woods era from 1944 to 1970-71 was actually an era where there were fixed exchange rates. That means that when nations traded and they exchanged money, They did that on the basis of having money that was valued by fixed rates. After the deregulation of Bretton Woods, the United States took the world off a gold standard. In other words, which meant that we no longer had fixed exchange rates. Now we were with floating exchange rates, which really entered a new period of history for the people who lived in the 1970s, because all of a sudden, massive amounts of credit were available. The idea that that we could borrow infinitely and not have to pay it back became popular. So algorithms began to take over the economy in ways that we, you know, even 5 or 10 years earlier, no one had any idea that could possibly happen, because the world was governed by fixed exchange rates. And fixed exchange rates led to stability because people had to balance their budgets. Nations, they could experience a trade surplus or a trade deficit, but it was always adjusted according to the fixed exchange rates. Well, that all went out the window with floating exchange rates. So that's the big difference now. And we're still in a floating exchange rate era. And the Green New Deal has not really begun to propose anything that's different, because they've embraced the idea of modern monetary theory. And there's a progressive wing that believes that this is the key to the future, and that it could fund a Green New Deal on a massive level by just borrowing from the future. But the fact is that it goes to the heart of what the problem is right now, which is that we don't have, society does not have a good understanding that the assets of nature are the real value of our currencies, even though it's not recognized. What we have now is a currency that is really attendant to the value of oil. And so the value of oil markets has a big influence on the valuation of today's currencies. But there are more factors that go into it. But there is a sense that scarce resources give a certain sense of value that lends our currencies to be able to express value that either is increasing or decreasing based on the increase or decrease of our resources that are available in nature. However, that function has been farmed out to the marketplace rather than the actual monitoring of our ecologies. So we're not measuring sustainability through our currencies. We're actually measuring market value of resources, which are not really resources anymore. They're turned into commodities. They're turned into goods and services for the marketplace. So if you'll look at the balance sheets of central banks, there are a lot of commercial assets on those balance sheets. And that has no place in a balance sheet for a central bank. And yet that's the situation we have. That's the operating system that we're working under right now. In the future, it would be really a very smart idea to begin to look at a way of measuring the sustainability of resources in nature, and then begin to use that as the basis of our asset valuation when it comes to the value of currencies. So we're in a crisis situation right now where there are some people calling for a return to fixed interest rates, which would mean either a return to the gold standard or possibly a return, a new dimension, which would be actually looking more along the lines of what I was just talking about, of using ecological value rather than commercial value to underpin our currency value.
So as we got off of the gold standard and shifted to oil as the de facto currency standard, as you suggest, what happens in a Green New Deal scenario where we're getting off of fossil fuels? What would be our monetary policy 10 years from now then?
Well, computers are giving us the algorithms that show that you can roll over debt ad infinitum. I mean, they map it out. But that is clashing with the reality that our resources are in decline. And so you can't just continue to say that on the basis of a computer and a computer program that we can continue to borrow resources from nature, because the fact is that we're running out of resources. So that's impossible to do. We're actually, if we were to finance a Green New Deal like that, we would actually be borrowing further from nature and further degrading nature in order to pay for programs that we think are going to actually improve nature. You know, a really good example of that is the transition from fossil fuels to solar energy. You know, the main reason why we're not being able to do that very rapidly, because it's been on the program for governments for 50 years, but, you know, it's been very slow progress. I mean, there are a lot of innovative solutions out there, but it's not scaling up as quickly as it needs to be. And the main reason for that is it takes fossil fuels to be able to build out the solar energy technologies that we need. And so we're not there yet where solar technologies can actually be created just by the production of solar energy alone. So it's a real dilemma, and we're not anywhere near being able to reverse that conundrum that we're in.
Like dogs sniff a berry bone, turn back the clock, take it in stride. Bright eyes will roll as bombs explode. You burn through time, say I got mine. This
is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to James Quilligan. He is the managing director of Economic Democracy Advocates. So, James, if we go back to what you were talking about with Bretton Woods in 1944 and the transition to the gold standard in 1971, and we see that a lot of international development was spurred on by organizations that were under a capitalist paradigm, like the IMF, the World Bank, and thinking also of FDR and the New Deal. These are good mechanisms for some large-scale transformations to economies. We can probably agree in terms of big projects. You know, the Tennessee Valley Authority is not going to be built by a micro-lending project like Kiva. But the resource democracy we're talking about does empower the individual to be able to be more self-sufficient and not be tied to the vagaries of the IMF or the World Bank. They can actually kind of take debt into their own hands and make their own buying decisions. How does the micro-lending and gig economy future square with some large-scale economic development projects like upgrading an electric grid, for example?
Yeah, the World Bank and the IMF were institutions created after World War II, which actually started out in the public interest. These were ideas that were formed by John Maynard Keynes, and he said that there needs to be institutions that actually extend loans to developing nations at a rate that's better than the rate that commercial banks are extending loans and offering aid to developing nations, and aid that doesn't have to be paid back, you know, to get the poorer countries back on their feet. So after the 1970s, that all changed when we went to floating exchange rates, because then the IMF and the World Bank did become directly part of the capitalist system. Before that, they were actually part of the progressive movement to ensure that there was a real New Deal for developing countries in the poor of the world. So that leads into the next idea around will a Green New Deal work right now? Why wouldn't it work? Well, those older ideas were about top-down management. You know, they were all about either, you know, even if it's giving loans to the poor of the world on a discounted rate or providing them with aid, it's still a top-down model. It doesn't really regenerate effectively development from the bottom up. So the idea of resource democracy now has to be something that's much more decentralized. It has to be from the bottom up at this point. That's why the problem with the Green New Deal is it's still a top-down model, and it even calls itself a New Deal, which is a very much part of the top-down model of Roosevelt's time, which is why we're never going to go back there, because the time for top-down government largesse is gone, and we really need to. This is one of the reasons why resource democracy has to be initiated from the bottom up, meaning that we create action groups on a local and regional basis to organize our own resources, because nobody else is going to do it for us.
Within the paradigm of sustainability and the Green New Deal and monetary policy, what is the future of democracy in your estimation?
We're losing our democracy. We're losing it on many levels. We're watching it in Washington, D.C., but we're also losing it at local levels, because part of the problem is that people want to have rights, but they don't want to take on responsibilities that allow them to have those rights, which is what the essence of democracy really is. So we're advocating that people really begin to get more engaged politically, to be able to manage their own resources, as well as to change the laws around the management of those resources. Otherwise, we're going to see more of the same thing. Our resources are going to continue to be privatized and regulated by government authorities in the interests of privatization, and people are going to lose their own sovereignty over their own resources. That's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is if we lose the heritage of democracy at this point in history, it'll probably be the case that we won't be able to recover it for quite some time, because the road ahead is paved with a lot of difficulty. And unless we have democracy to navigate us through that chaos that's going to happen as a result of the clash over resources, then we're going to be in really bad straits.
James Quilligan, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to SeaChange Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise. That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. The music you heard was written and performed by Alex Wise. Velour, Split the Sky, I Got Mine, and Come What May. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio.
thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Alex Wise of Sea Change Radio. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
Palestinians deserve human rights, freedom, justice, and equality, just like everyone else does. We want firm commitments from candidates that they're going to cut U.S. military funding for the Israeli military because of the human rights violations that they've been mired in.
Egyptian-Palestinian student activist Mo El-Sherbini is with Jewish Voice for Peace Action. He says Democratic candidates often avoid discussing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Yesterday, President Donald Trump weighed in.
Together, we can bring about a new dawn in the Middle East.
The president unveiled a new so-called conditional two-state solution with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at his side, just hours after the prime minister was indicted in Jerusalem on three separate corruption charges. President Trump says he'll address what he calls, quote, the most difficult challenge of all, unquote, forging peace between Israelis and Palestinians.
I was not elected to do small things or shy away from big problems.
The initiative was widely reported to be without input or approval from Palestinian leaders as relations were cut off after Trump moved the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem.
President Trump has made it clear that he has absolutely no interest whatsoever in working toward equality for all, for Palestinians and Israelis. He is completely and totally supporting Prime Minister Netanyahu's agenda.
Beth Miller, also with Jewish Voice for Peace Action. Netanyahu's fighting to remain in office. Former Southland Mayor Pete Buttigieg suggests Trump's support has a cynical component.
He has infused domestic politics, making U.S. foreign policy choices in order to effectively interfere in Israeli domestic politics, acting as though that somehow makes him pro-Israel and pro-Jewish.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, the two Jewish candidates in the Democratic primary, differ on what support for Israel means. Sanders says he believes Israel has the right to exist in peace and security, but also that
what U.S. foreign policy must be about is not just being pro-Israel, we must be pro-Palestinian.